LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
The Donald Trump search warrant affidavit is here, as is Joe Biden's student debt relief program. All that and more on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising, with Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
We're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. Maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage and I can see through these guys.
Let's do it. Welcome back to The Uprising, Mr. Timothy Alting Donner, LibertyNation.com senior political analyst.
Hello, Scott.
Well, what a day, what a week. It's been a whirlwind.
What a rare mood you're in.
For me, first up, by the way, let's thank Uprising listeners who helped get the official Uprising computer back up and running today. I don't know if I'm going to get a bill in the mail or not, but as yet, it's been free of charge, the help that came. And we help.
Let's give Max them up.
Mr. Max and Mr. John. Boy, thank you so much.
Let's give Max and John a spot on the Uprising in a week to be determined.
Friends of the show, to be sure. Okay,
yes.
Well, it has been a newsy week as well. In addition to dealing with some tech crises, let's just say we've got Fauci retiring. We've got the student loans announcement. We've got the Mar-a-Lago search warrant affidavit released. We've got Zuckerberg talking about the FBI, and we're going to try to get to all of it. We'll see. Let's start, Tim. I think, for me, what's most on my mind, we're recording now on Friday afternoon. We delayed the recording of the Uprising so that we get to get access to the search warrant affidavit. We've seen it. We've published it. LibertyNation.com, first on the scene, Tim, publishing the read in full of the document.
I'll tell you what, it's going to kill a bunch of printers because of all the black ink that has to be released to cover all the redactions, pages.
Right. They need to learn how to, they need to, you know what? This is, by the way, once in a while I have one of these brilliant ideas, and I'm giving this one to you. Okay, here you go. You could start this like fake environmentalism trend to have the redactions only be in white, both on the ink front and on the racism front. Like, a redaction is bad. Why's it got to be black? So
that's,
you get
right,
double down on the virtue signaling.
I'm willing to take my part as a white person and release the stigma attached to the redaction.
You're gonna make headlines with this, Tim.
Yes.
I hope you take that ball and run with it. That's a little present for you. All right, the redactions were 14 of the 32 pages, I think, were redacted in their entirety. I counted it before, and I've forgotten my counting, but it's significant redactions. What does it say? Well, it says that they want to go after Donald Trump for Espionage Act violations, for some other violations of destroying government documents, and for obstruction of justice. Regarding his handling of these documents. One of the kind of new things that we've seen from it is they released this letter. They included the letter in their application for the search warrant. So this is a letter that Trump's lawyer, this guy Corcoran, that he sent the U.S. attorney and the guy who's like in charge of this thing, who is with the Counterintelligence and Export Control section of the National Security Division of the DOJ, right? So he's sending that guy a letter. It's a May 25 letter. That's the date where he basically makes this whole argument about how you shouldn't kind of go after a president of the United States or a past president or charge them with anything because of this. And so what I think is kind of interesting about that, Tim, is, well, first of all, the judge obviously disagreed because he issued the search warrant. Now, that's number one. But here's the other thing. It does kind of give lie to the idea where, if you recall, just last week or whatever, 2 weeks ago, when was the warrant executed anyway? A hell of a lot later than May 25 when this letter was sent. The Trump lawyers, and I think Trump himself, made it out like, hey, we were real palsy. We were getting along with these guys. Right. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, we turn around and they're searching through our underwear drawers.
They
not true based on what we see here in this letter. What we see here in this letter, that by May 25, and certainly before then at some point, but we know by May 25, things had broken down to the point where the Trump team had sufficiently thought that criminal charges were coming, that they wrote in their thing, this is why you should not issue criminal charges against Donald Trump. So,
well, I think, in my opinion, this release of this heavily redacted affidavit, which he figures, 40-45% of the whole thing is redacted. To me, it settles nothing, and it actually makes things worse, because the leftist narrative that they're building about this criminal ex-president will say 38 pages, there must have been a lot of bad stuff in there. And the people building the opposite narrative on the right are going to say, see, they won't tell you anything. They're trying to hide their persecution of Trump. So, you know, this is not going to help anything. And I guess I sort of expected this magistrate to sort of superintend the release, so to speak, that he might have said, you know, isn't there any more, or there should be more that's in there, because the purpose of releasing it is so that people can find out what this is all about. And this does not help that process. I think, Scott, it makes it worse, not because it's the wrong thing to do, but the end result is, I think it makes it worse because it just polarizes the two sides even more. There's no hard information.
You're right. There's some.
But most of it was just confirming what we'd heard before about.
Oh, wait, just stop
boxes,
you right there.
You know.
It's not confirming what we heard. It's confirming what the Justice Department already leaked. So that's
or the Trump people.
No. The leaks have come from the warrant came from Trump.
Right.
But the leaks about the affidavit and the motivations have all come from one source, the Justice Department. And so that part of the reason why it makes sense to argue for a more expansive version of whatever may be released is because we've already seen, and this is an argument I think Jonathan Turley's made in your favorite paper there, the New York Post, that basically we have like a double standard whereby the defense, as it were, just for lack of a better term, the target, perhaps Donald Trump's team, doesn't have anything to release in terms of, they don't know what's going on. Right. So they make an argument in court that says this thing should come out. The Justice Department goes to court and says, oh, no, it's not appropriate for these things to come out. And then anything that they actually do want to come out, they just go ahead and say,
just leak
it. They feed it to some friendly reporter and it comes out. And then
they offer a redacted, heavily redacted version.
And we know from Comey and the rest that, you know, they're leakers. Like, if they leak when they wanna, you know, that's just how they roll.
Now, let me ask you this. What are the things that the founders were most concerned with when it came to law enforcement? Was a concept of a general warrant. Now, in this case, using that term, general warrant, as you see it, based on what you know as an attorney, do you feel like the FBI went in there with their 30 agents or 40, whatever it was, and treated this as if it was a general warrant for them to just turn the whole place upside down, justified by whatever was in the warrant?
This is not a general warrant. This has nothing to do with a general warrant.
But I'm not using the term inappropriately, I admit. But what I'm saying is a sense
Firstly, it certainly gives me no surprise to learn that you're interested in the perspective from a bunch of old dead white guys who were slave owners. Okay, when you go back to the founders, let's modernize our concern, Tim, and bring it up to the 2022s here. What I think you're suggesting is, and I give you no penalty points for not being able to articulate exactly this way, is were they there in order to create basically a predicate, because I chose to lecture you instead of just go on with it, I've actually forgotten the term myself.
See what happens. See what happens.
Yeah. So when the police want to pull somebody over, Tim, to search their drugs, their car for narcotics, you know, a lot of times they don't have the legal right to do that. So they just follow them for a couple blocks, as you know, and it's impossible to operate a motor vehicle on the streets without violating some law. They do it. And then they have the legal right to say, they get a free sniff. The person lowers the window down. Then it's like, I smell the odor of burnt marijuana. And they have the legal right. Then if they're in a place, like, let's say, they're allowed to get in the trunk, for instance, if they have if the dog alerts on the trunk, right? Well, once you get in the trunk, you're allowed to look in the trunk. You may not be allowed to look in a container in the trunk if you're a police officer. That may depend, okay? But you're allowed to open the trunk lid. Well, if you think of a similar situation with Mar-a-Lago and Donald Trump's documents, it's like, let's say you want to see what documents he has, or you want to. Do you think you may discover certain documents that you're interested in either A, verifying that he has, or B, seizing, right? You may not have the legal right to go in for those documents, but if you can establish the legal right to go in, inspect, and seize, quote unquote, certain documents, that means you can go then for any document and right. Look at it, right? To see if it matches this other one. So the answer to your question is, yeah, this very well could be, an engineered effort to get access to those documents. We know that, just to get back on track with what was confirmed by the search warrant affidavit, this came from a National Archives basically throwing a flag up to the Department of Justice. And they said, hey, we got a bunch of materials from this Trump office, by the way. And we think it's, problematic because it's got these security designators and blah, blah, blah with it.
Right.
Can you investigate this? But what we don't have as of yet that I'm aware of is confirmation from the National Archives and Records Administration that nobody from the White House told or suggested that they initiate that communication from. So it's like, hey, listen, I didn't request this. We got a call from housekeeping, and they're the ones that said you made a mess. I didn't come and initiate on my own a complaint against you. But if I told the housekeeping girl, hey, listen, I think this guy's a bum crumb and you better, keep a special eye on him. And if anything happens, call us. And then they do. Well, guess what? You initiated that. You can't say you have clean hands in the investigation. So that's something that I hope.
Well, look, the White House has plausible deniability on this whole thing by basically everybody saying we had nothing to do with it. I think, a reasonable person would conclude that Biden basically put out the word that the Justice Department is to put its foot heavily on the gas when it comes
to Trump
without saying anything specifically, but giving essentially,
I get the gist of what you're saying. Blush. And I like that as an operating principle, like, hey, we're all adults here. You wouldn't have that job as head of the whatever agency if you didn't know how to move the levers of power in the favor of those who put you in that position. And that's why they put you there, by the way, right? That's what you're there for. That's your job. So
that goes just unstated. You don't have to tell people that, but I think it's also interesting, Scott, what's not in the redacted affidavit. So it's 38 pages and we get over 20 pages worth of stuff that we can actually see that doesn't have black ink all over it. But the two things that have been floated out there to make people think, ooh, this is horrible. Number one, the violations of the Espionage Act, as if Trump was selling secrets, top secrets, to his friends in Russia. And the other one was nuclear secrets.
The atomic age, Tim.
They kept dropping nuclear and espionage, and there is nothing in this affidavit.
I'm glad we as a nation, we've seemed to really grown from the George Bush nuclear days. Nuclear. You don't hear that
anymore. I prefer nuclear.
Yeah, I know that you do, but
I have to stop myself from doing that.
I'm glad we've done it because
George, that's the most powerful thing George W. Bush did. He changed the language.
But you're right. They did use, it was nuclear, scare tactics, right? But we don't see any of that in at least the revealed portion of the affidavit. I would say to you that there is one thing, though, that is beyond the kind of everybody knows go after Trump permission or orders that Biden has issued, if not explicitly, then implicitly, and through everything that he says that's not explicitly saying it implicitly does. But there's one other thing that is very much explicit, and it's kind of a big deal, I think, and it is that the National Archives and Record Administration said that Trump did not have executive privilege over the documents that he claimed to have executive privilege over because the White House said they were waiving the privilege. And I think it's super important to talk about because we've never had before one White House saying that they can waive the executive privilege of a president that's come before. Only this is one of these only is Donald Trump so bad that we've ever had to do this in history is the kind of argument you're getting from the other side.
Right.
But the problem then becomes is every successive administration from presumably an opposite party or adversarial, to the previous one will then go ahead and strip the executive privileges of their communication so they can embarrass and to use it to their advantage. And then what happens, and, the reason why this is all important is so that the president can communicate with people and get good advice and get good information without everybody thinking that every email they send is going to be, published in a newspaper, because you're not going to get good information or good advice then. You're going to get information and advice that looks good when printed in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
And so I think that's a real problem. And Trump, just like every president before him, should be able to rely on that privilege.
But
turning the world upside down to punish Donald Trump in the post-presidency, by the way, here's the thing.
Are all different. Yeah.
This is so crazy to me politically, Tim. It's like this is only accruing to Donald Trump's political resurrection and like cementing him in the Republican primary, right?
Well, it does, but I think there's this big debate, and I did a column on it a while back called "Do Democrats Want Trump In or Out in 2024?" And some people would say, "Of course they want him out." Well, not so fast, because there's also a school of thought which is legitimate to argue that Trump is maybe the only Republican that can't win in 2024. So the best of all worlds for them is to weaken him significantly in a way that actually strengthens him among Republicans, which is what happens with this raid, but which weakens him then.
So he's worse off before a general election audience, but better off before primary.
I've got to think so. It depends about the exchange made between those people who will vote for Trump because they're scared to death of political persecution of political enemies versus the people that say, because of the raid, on top of everything else that's happened with Trump and all the scandals that have been perpetuated by the left and the media, that, look, I just can't deal with Trump anymore. I just can't take the drama every day. So, you could say if they were really clever, which I don't think they're quite clever enough, but they think, let's, they did this in the primaries. Scott, you
Hold on just one second. Hold on just one second before you
get to let me just finish the thought for a second, because it's relevant too. In the primaries, the Democrats have in more than one race actually poured money into the coffers of the MAGA friendly candidates because they believe they're more beatable. Well, why wouldn't the same thing perhaps apply to Donald Trump?
Yeah. You know, I always caution against that, no matter who the purveyor of the bounty for the other side is in terms of campaign largesse, because you never really know how that's going to work out. I can recall saying to you, I think at your excitement, perhaps, that Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee because you thought that she would be beatable. And I and if it wasn't you, it was somebody else in my life that I discussed politics with. And I thought, if she doesn't run, she can't win. If she runs, there's a possibility.
It's no everything's matter what, a race to roll win. With the dice.
So I never want to buoy somebody up who I wouldn't want in the office because there's a potential that actually works. But I want to get into a point.
That's
I want to get to a different point real quick, which is just, I totally get the kind of idea that people have been talking about. I've heard this, like, that it creates a fatigue of like, oh, no more Trump. We're just done with all this Trump, like, again, with more. Now it's a search warrant and it's this. But here's the other side of that coin. And I just distinctly remember it because, of course, the Clintons sort of invented it. This scandal fatigue, and the scandal fatigue with the Clintons was that there were so many scandals that they actually benefited from there being so many. Because if you just drill down on the two or three most scandalous ones, you know, you throw them out on their ear. But
right. It's sort of like, can't they leave this guy alone?
Exactly. Yeah, so could we actually see, and I'm asking you in your official capacity as LibertyNation.com senior political editor, is there some middle purple America who might actually be like, you know what? They really are out to get this guy. This seems crazy. They would have never done this if it was a Democrat.
Yes, I think I think there's a lot of people in this country. We tend to think in terms of left and right, but there's a ton of people in this country who do not consider themselves either liberal or conservative. People in both parties, and of course, independents, which now dwarf both Republicans and Democrats. It's 40% of the country declares himself as independent. So I think those people, where it's not ideological, that the concept of persecuting, going after your political enemies using the FBI, the premier law enforcement agency in the country, is frightening, I think, to enough people who don't care about the ideology. They don't particularly like Trump or Biden, for example, but this scares them. On the other hand, that's it. How does it weigh against the people who are like, just can't deal with Trump anymore? That's the question about this Mar-a-Lago raid. But one thing it's certainly done, Scott, is it has knocked Ron DeSantis and any other hopefuls for the 2024 presidency.
Yeah, they just booked their they just booked their European river cruise for for 2 years.
And you know, look, DeSantis isn't in any hurry. He's 43 years old. He can pick his spot at the appropriate time in the future. And
if you're DeSantis and you get asked if you'll be on Trump's ticket as VP, what do you say?
Oh, we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, I'm putting you right there. It just occurred to me.
Running for office again, I'd say, well, look, Scott, it's way too early to be concerned.
By the way, this is why I
intend to first. I have to, you know, to win another 4 years in Florida as their governor.
This is why I saluted Liz Cheney, even in the face of her insane presidential aspirations, that at least she didn't pretend she didn't have them. That's one sane thing about it, is that she didn't make it out like she didn't want to be president or wouldn't run if she thought, you know, she could do it. I'm asking you sincerely. Trump says to DeSantis, will you be my running mate? I'm running again. He's got to say no, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
DeSantis, no.
He'll never be president if he says yes to Trump.
Well, he might be, but here's the thing. Donald Trump will never even consider picking a running mate that has any opportunity to overshadow
him. Agreed. Yeah.
I mean, Mike Pence was perfect because he was low-key and willing to act what the left calls just like a supplicant, you know, to Trump.
By the way, I'm happy to have a vice president that's waiting for the president to die because that's what his role is.
Isn't that what the job is?
Go do something and listen until the president dies.
Yeah. I mean, I hear all these people saying about, you know, the president, the vice presidency isn't worth a warm bucket of spit. I'm not sure which old time politician said that. But look, how many jobs allow you to preside over the world's greatest deliberative body with no real responsibility, with the opportunity to turn a 50-50 vote one way or the other?
Tim.
And you can travel all over the world with all of the privilege.
Now you're getting
the responsibility.
You're on a private jet. Who wouldn't want that?
Who wouldn't want that job?
No security lines. You know, I'll tell you what.
No security.
Well, you know, it's a funny joke. I was speaking to another uprising listener like a week or so ago about President Trump talking about how they allegedly took a couple of his passports and what passports he might have. And I was describing the difference between a regular U.S. passport and a diplomatically issued passport. The red covered passport. I think they're still red. Anyway, you know, and we were just chatting about it. And he's like, oh, yeah. So how would he's like a president, you know, just talking out loud. A president doesn't need a passport, does he? And I was like, a president arrives, you know, with his cars already waiting for him, with a basically like a private army when he travels, and just talking out loud about the way he was like, oh, well, that's it. Trump's running again. And I thought, yeah, like the trappings of there is no person on earth that's treated like the president of the United States of America. Their wants and desires, every whim, are just catered to. You go where you want, when you want, and how.
And they
should
be, because there's so much responsibility in the weight of the world. But imagine having that same job without any of the responsibility, or the same privileges without any of the responsibility. That's the vice presidency.
So you still
get all the circumstances.
I would say to you, by the way, I appreciated what you said that they should be because of the responsibility. I would actually say that's not the right reaction. The right reaction is they shouldn't be, and they shouldn't have all the responsibility. Like the idea that one person, we can count on that one, whoever it is, Trump, by the way, in fact, perfect example, because almost like what are the percentages of Americans who believe that Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the people they would pick to hold on to that power? Almost nobody, right? Like,
Trump, they would. There's a lot of people.
No,
literally would.
Excuse
but Biden,
me, you're not understanding my question. You're not understanding my question. Who would say that both of them are the people to do that? That Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the people who would pick Trump would never say that Biden was right.
No. So, but they wouldn't admit that anybody was acceptable in the left. We certainly wouldn't accept that Trump is. It's like, no, but you bring up a really a good point, Scott, which is that, you know, most, I'll just take it from the Republican side, the Democrats have had the same effect at sometimes in the past. But all you heard from Republicans over the years was how they, quote, held their nose and voted for George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, John McCain.
Yeah.
Okay, he's better than the alternative, lesser of two evils.
Sure.
With Trump, for the most part, it's like, this guy is someone that I would stand in line for all day to vote for. He's the first guy I saw, except for Obama, on the left.
Well, you got to hold your nose for Trump for different reasons, for the cultural, vulgar part of his public persona that nobody wants. That I see on the Republican side to celebrate, you know, the Rosie O'Donnell tweets and that kind of thing. So there's no sort of, you know, perfect candidate, right? He's but politically on the votes, on the no wars, on the lower taxes, on that kind of stuff.
On the roaring economy.
They don't have to. Well, yeah, I mean, that's. I tend to want to dial back. I'm more about the I care more about the policy rather than what some people attribute the result to, only because we can argue about what the policy is. We may not be able to get to a point with us being able to agree that X policy equals X result. But we know what the policy is. So if the policy is...
Well, we know the end result.
Well, we don't know if that end result... We don't know if the result was the result... So I'll just give you an example. If a new president comes in and he reduces capital gains tax to some significant margin, and economic activity increases significantly after that, we don't know that that reduction in taxes was the reason why the economic activity increased. We can say that it's likely, or we think that that's the reason.
I think over the course of a presidency, over 4 years, or especially eight, a president's policies can be pretty much cause and effect. I mean, the Carter presidency and the Reagan presidency were reversed in terms of results and reversed in terms of policy. So you can fairly say the Carter policies were a failure and the Reagan policies were a success based on the end result, which is the economy.
I'll give you an example of what I'm thinking of, and I think I'm going to get you to turn around and agree with me. All right, here you go. There were people, economists, in the Clinton administration when he was going through the biggest boom times America had probably seen since after the war, the Great War, that is, that boom time could actually be attributed to Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative and the peace dividend with the technology that then fueled the tech sector. And basically, for those people, you have to credit more substantially Ronald Reagan than you would Bill Clinton for that boom. So I'm saying but there are plenty of people who would say, especially I think Bill Clinton first among them, that no, it was Bill Clinton.
Right.
So my point is just
nobody really believes that. But
my point is just
a talking point.
To agree to argue about the results is to take some leap of faith.
When
we can just argue about the policy, we all agree that this is the X, Y, and Z is the
policy. We can also look at things, though, that are not necessarily quantifiable. For example, if Reagan had not been president, do you think Bill Clinton would have gotten up and said the era of big government is over? Which, of course, it isn't. But the point is, a Democrat president saying that following the Reagan and Bush,
I don't think that had much to do with it. I think it was just a response to the Republican Revolution. And he would have said it if the same.
Right. But the revolution was successful because the country was booming during the Reagan years.
This is a perfect example. You're asking me to agree that Reagan was at some point the cause of that. And maybe you can make.
Are you going to say he wasn't?
By the way, we are
seriously.
We are so far down the rabbit hole.
We're going to have to tighten this up. But that's what's fun.
All right. So, all right. I'm going to spend another moment on this, and then we're going to move on. You've said, because Ronald Reagan performed as he did as president, that created a situation whereby, in response to Bill Clinton's first term governance, then there was the backlash, which was the Republican winning the House for the first time in, I don't know how many years, 47 years.
A long time.
There you go. And then that led to Bill Clinton saying the era of big government is over.
Yes, essentially that's true. He created what Reagan did was create a demand. I'm not going to say a groundswell, but look, he won two elections, one which was speculative, where he won 45 states, and the other, which was on his first term presidency, in which he won 49 states. I think it's pretty safe to say that people bought what he was selling, and that Clinton was smart to take his party away from McGovern and Mondale and Dukakis to the center.
That's why he won in the first place, and that's why he won re-election, 100%. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that we can trace what happened from voters in 1979 through there on a straight line. But we're going to resolve that in our electoral podcast of the 20th century, the sub-podcast that's soon to come out sometime in, maybe next year when we have time for
We call it the sub-pod?
we're gonna move along. All right, let's just... Let's just button up our discussion, if we would, of the of the search warrant affidavit. Where do you think this leaves things? Is Team MAGA, are they energized by this? You said it was just going to lead to more kind of polarization. I tend to think you're probably right. It's almost hard for me to think of what wouldn't lead to an increase in polarization.
Yeah, that's true. You're right.
But is this particularly gas on a fire for Team MAGA, or is it just a nothing burger, or where do you rate it politically as far as that? And also on the other side.
You know, Trump has an amazing ability to function with cannons aimed at him from every direction. So is he energized? I think he is. I think he is because his base has been energized and he needed something to lift him because he was dropping steadily because of the January 6th thing, the committee.
And because of the continuing show trial. Social media ban, by the way.
That too. You know, but the show trial was a slow drip that was taking him down. DeSantis was on the rise. Then all of a sudden, boom, this happens. And now his narrative about how he's being targeted falls right into place. His supporters look at it and say, see, here's the proof again that they're out to get this guy any way they can. I think that this freezes things pretty much in place until we find out more, until there's an actual indictment. And I would ask you, throw back to you, if there's an indictment coming, let's say related to, I don't know, there's the New York case, there's this case, there's everything that they apparently took out of Mar-a-Lago. If they do an indictment, is this something you think they would do before the midterm elections? After?
Oh, man.
Do you think they're going to definitely indict?
I can't even pretend I have like a basis in my professional experience or knowledge to, you know, intelligently answer that question. It's just a total speculation. Boy, Tim, I totally hope not, because I think it would be seen as completely political. But also maybe that's the reason for the entirety of the thing itself, is to do it so that it is political and to make something happen for the powers that be before the election cycle. It's
my understanding is that, you know, and the background of this is that we now have confirmed something that I didn't really think had happened, strangely enough, which is that the FBI itself actually went to social media, and in this case specifically Facebook, and told Mark Zuckerberg, or persuaded him, shall we say, not to cover the Biden laptop story.
Let's go ahead and listen to Zuckerberg tell Joe Rogan that.
You know, obviously this is a hyper-political issue, so depending on what side of the political spectrum, you either think we didn't censor it enough or censored it way too much. But
right. But
we weren't sort of as black and white about it as Twitter. We just kind of thought, hey, look, if the FBI, which, you know, I still view as a legitimate institution in this country, it's like very professional law enforcement, they come to us and tell us that we need to be on guard about something, then I want to take that seriously.
Did they specifically say you need to be on guard about that story?
I don't remember if it was that specifically, but it basically fit the pattern.
When something like that turns out to be real, is there regret for not having it evenly distributed and for throttling the distribution of that story?
What do you mean evenly distributed?
I mean evenly in that it's not suppressed. It's not.
I mean, it sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because it turned out after the fact, the fact checkers looked into it. No one was able to say it was false, right? So basically it had this period where it was getting list distribution. I think it sucks though. I think in the same way that probably having to go through like a criminal trial but being proven innocent in the end sucks. Like, it still sucks to have like that you had to go through a criminal trial, but at the end you're free. I don't know if the answer would have been don't do anything or don't have any process. I think the process was pretty reasonable. You know, we still let people share it, but obviously you don't want situations like that.
But certainly much more reasonable than Twitter stance. And it's probably also the case of armchair quarterbacking, right? Or at least Monday morning quarterbacking, I should say, because in the moment, you had reason to believe, based on the FBI talking to you, that it wasn't real and that there was going to be some propaganda. So what do you do?
Yeah.
And then if you just let it get out there, and what if it changes the election and it turns out to be bullshit, that's a real problem. And I would imagine that those kind of decisions are the most difficult. The decisions of, like, what is allowed and what is not allowed.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a simpler conclusion than, absent the FBI's talking to Facebook authorities, the Hunter Biden laptop story is treated like any other and allowed widespread exposure and therefore vote denigration to Biden's campaign and accrual of votes to Trump? I mean, that's the plain takeaway, right?
I think that there's a couple of things happening here with this. The first of them is, in 2020, after what happened in 2016, when Comey, then FBI Director James Comey, put out 11 days before the election that he had reopened, essentially, the case into Hillary Clinton's emails, the Clinton campaign, and I think justifiably, claimed that that really, if it didn't cost them the election, it helped cost them the election. And the last thing the FBI was going to do was pull another October surprise on Biden 4 years later with the laptop story that would go mainstream and would take him down. Trump would have a second term, and then democracy would die, Scott.
In darkness, Tim.
Yes, in darkness.
You know, the thing that we need to do is, and I'm not suggesting that this actually happened absent congressional authorization, so I don't need any investigations of me for suggesting that I'm arguing for property damage or anything like that, but commensurate with appropriate federal, state, and local legislation, Tim, to be passed forthwith, we just, October 1, lights out at the FBI, mandatory vacation until after Election Day. You know,
I'm no sure the agents would like that.
Anything you got to arrest anybody? You're arresting by 30 days after September, right? September 30th, that's your deadline. Arrested by then or just after Election Day. Plenty of arrests. Go ahead and arrest everybody you want the day after Election Day. But give some buffer where, you know, there is no, they don't comment about stuff. They don't say anything. They don't indict anybody at that level. There's no reason to indict Donald Trump between September 30th and the first week in November.
But it's an emergency.
Right? Yeah.
It's just like the student loans. They actually are terming the student loan debt an emergency.
Once again. What a great podcast partner. Unintentional segue. Boom. Transition right away. Tim, let's talk about.
Am I good?
Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. announces to the American people this week, finally, Tim. In my piece for the sponsor of today's podcast, LibertyNation.com, I said Godot arrives on the headline.
Yes.
Because he'd been teasing this out and talking about it for, I don't know, since the campaign, I guess. And we finally got it. Let's listen to our, 46. Let's listen to 46 on student loans.
Using the authority Congress granted the Department of Education, we will forgive $10,000 in outstanding federal student loans. In addition, students who come from low-income families, which allowed them to qualify to receive a Pell Grant, will have their debt reduced $20,000. Both of these targeted actions are for families who need it the most. Working and middle-class people hit especially hard during the pandemic, making under $125,000 a year. If you make more than that, you don't qualify. No high-income individual or high-income household on top of the 5%, in the top 5% of incomes, by the way, will benefit from this action, period. In fact, about 90% of the eligible beneficiaries make under $75,000 a family. Here's what that means. If you make under $125,000, you get $10,000 knocked off your student debt. If you make under $125,000 a year and you received a Pell Grant, you'll get an additional $10,000 knocked off that total, for a total of $20,000 relief.
95% of the borrowers can benefit from these actions. That's 43 million people.
Well, Scott, you know what? Everybody knows that parties do things to shore up their support before an election. It's what politics is all about. But I think in all the years that I have watched, heard, read, studied politics, I've never seen such a naked play for votes as literally buying the votes of people at the expense of the rest of the country. I mean, think about someone who's paid their loans, okay? They did what Bill Clinton called worked hard and played by the rules, right? And they repaid their student loan.
Right.
And now here comes this president in a desperate attempt to salvage something from the midterms, just literally says, okay, I mean, he might as well have said, I'll pay you to vote for me. I mean, it's just that naked. And what does this say about, you know, to a generation, a rising generation that is kind of identified by their sort of entitlement mentality? What does it say? It says, hey, if you think something's unfair, get progressives to demand that the government take care of it because it's unfair. And so who cares about all the people that did it the way that they had committed to in writing, legally incurring debt, but now they're going to wipe it off for the sake of the midterm elections. I think it is the most nakedly political use of taxpayer funds, to the tune of, what is it, up to $600 billion over time.
No.
And $2,000 per person.
That is a number that the New York State Federal Reserve, I think, put out there that absolutely, that's a bad number. And here's the reason why it's a bad number. I've got a lot more to talk about.
Well, there's
some of the details.
Look, there's other numbers that are almost as high.
But let's talk about this one thing for now, the actual cost of it. And here's why I think that you can't even say. So first of all, in terms of how many people take advantage of that 10K and 20K respectively, they can't say how much that's going to cost because they don't know who's going to apply for the benefits.
Of course.
It is kind of funny. I'll reserve the clip, but there is the Biden official basically saying, well, we don't know. Well, you know, one of the things that's pissing off progressives about this, Tim, is especially since that the benefits are as low as they are. What I mean by that is they don't come remotely close to approaching the total cost of a college education that some of the folks thought that they should go ahead. And
it's a token bouquet.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. So that's the, you know, a lot of progressives are on that side of things. And of course, even if it's $100 bill, I mean, the reason not to do it are there, right? It's totally wrong to subject the taxpayers to the loans.
But it's one thing also, Scott, if there's an act of Congress. It's another thing for a president in the executive branch.
Okay, so the mechanism, so it's
to just by the stroke of a pen declare
There's that to talk about as well. But let me just say the one thing where I want to talk about the reason why I think that the number that is just impossible to believe. And here's I'm just going to put it out there to you. One of the provisions of this plan, and this was not really talked about at all with the kind of leaks that had come out. This was only released with the plan itself, is that payments for undergraduate loans are going to be capped at 5% of discretionary income. Now, that means that after you pay your rent, your utilities, your food, your car payment, your taxes, okay? So I don't know what that number is, but let's say you make 50 grand a year. What do you think discretionary income on a father of two who makes 50 grand a year is?
Maybe 2,000.
I mean, it's not a lot of money.
No, seriously,
right?
it's maybe 10% if he's lucky. That's 5,000.
I mean, let's go wild and let's say it's $10,000.
Right.
You can only then 5% of that $10,000 is the maximum that that person can be billed in that year for their student loans. So hear me out now. Let's say you're a student, you're weighing potential, you know, loan, you know, you're going to go to a fantastically expensive school like your alma mater, Tim, or a moderate state school like somebody else might go to. Okay,
some other random person,
and you know, you're weighing it out, like and the 4-year total for, I mean, you think about what's like a Sarah Lawrence, it's probably like $1 million now or something like that. Like they're off the charts with their tuition and fees. But if you know you're never going to have to pay more than 5% of your salary, well, if you don't plan on making a high salary, right? If you're willing to go to Harvard for that for the sociology degree to then go work, you know, and be a social worker, why not go to Harvard? Why go to State U for it if you're only going to be committing 5% anyway? And at the end of the 20 years of repayment history, with that 5%, the debt's extinguished. So what I think we're going to see, this I think is a perfect example of the law of unintended consequences. If you're not responsible for the debt, you're only responsible for a maximum. What do you care if you're paying? Let's say the maximum you can pay is $100 a month. What do you care if it's $100 a month working down a debt of $10 million or $100,000 or $100 a month working down a debt of $50,000 if you're never going to pay the principal anyway? You're just paying $100 a month, right?
Right.
So I think we're going to see that debt. I think this is going to be one of those things where if it lasts that long, and we can talk about legal challenges maybe as well with respect to that justification for the, you know, his signing his name rather than a congressional approval of it. But I think that it's going to balloon, Tim, geometrically from that $600 billion number. So that's why I want to just kind of make that presentation of why I think it's going to go that way.
Well, the one thing I will say is that because it's being done by executive action, it can be reversed by the next president if he wants to do it. But by then, the toothpaste is out of the tube. And once you give people an entitlement.
Yeah, that 10 grand ain't coming back.
You can't come back on it. Yeah. You try to do it and you're going to get crushed, especially by this rising generation. And basically, and this isn't even an insult necessarily, but they don't want to pay for anything because they're used to the internet where you can find whatever you want for free.
Where they're the product.
What do you say?
Where they're the product.
With what?
Where they are the product. So the line is like, oh, I don't pay for email. Like, yeah, you don't pay for email because they're selling you. The email company is giving you the email to sell your data to somebody else. So sure, you are the product.
Care. Yeah.
I get it. Yeah, they're used
it's
to not
true.
Paying
they don't
for
care. But this is the way I figure this goes. Here's how I think the Democrats figured this. Biden will just go ahead. He's never going to get an act of Congress. Nobody in Congress is going to support this in an election year. But he can get an immediate, he believes, and I think this is a boomerang. I think he's absolutely wrong. And I think Biden's bailout boomerang is the name of my article that's going up Saturday morning on LibertyNation.com. But what he's doing here is he's figuring, okay, it's probably not constitutional for a president with a stroke of a pen to wipe away debt and charge the American people for it, including the people who were incensed enough that they played by the rules and now they got played as suckers. But he figures if he goes ahead and does it, he's going to get more votes from these pesky millennials who don't tend to show up in great numbers. They'll show up in gratitude. And so will the, you know, liberal professionals who are highly or even overeducated. He'll get them to vote out of gratitude for this. And then once the election's over, if it goes all the way to the Supreme Court and the Supremes, as they likely will do, rule it unconstitutional, well, who cares? Because the whole effect is on the midterms. They don't care about anything past that. And by 2024, no one will remember that.
I would just disagree with one thing that you said there, which is that it's likely that the Supreme Court overturns this.
Well, maybe not likely. I would bet if I had
I don't
to
think
bet,
it's likely at all.
I'll say, really? You think that the act that was used as a justification for this will pass muster, an act designed specifically.
I don't know that it'll ever see muster. I don't agree. So let me make something clear. I'm not saying it is constitutional, and therefore that's why it'll be held unconstitutional. I'm just saying there are a number of stumbling blocks to get from point A, which is where we are now, to point the end of the line, which would be a Supreme Court overturning this. This
measure. Or they could just affirm something that the lower court had already ruled, which is that it's unconstitutional.
Or that it's not justiciable, that it's a political question. Okay. There are a number of pathways to not get ultimate judgment. So,
but if it gets to the Supreme Court, which you've got to think it will, because a conservative group is going to file suit, and then it's going to go to a district court, and then one side or the other will appeal, go to the appellate court, and it'll eventually wind up in the Supreme Court.
It may eventually.
I don't know about you, but I would definitely, if I had a gun to my head, there's no question, I would bet that they will find it not constitutional, either affirming or overturning a lower court decision to that effect.
I'm not convinced it will go to the Supreme Court, but I'm willing to play the game of what's my bet if it does go.
Sure.
And I could see, because of his ruling in the Title IX, I think it was the trans issue, that Gorsuch basically Gorsuch has a way of reading laws, and when outcomes that were never anticipated in that law are read against the plain text of the law, he has an analysis that often says, hey, write a better law. I'm not going to clean up your mess. Okay. You didn't want to include every human being on earth when you wrote this law to help veterans. I'm not saying you didn't write it to help veterans. Clearly you did, but you also wrote it in a way that it could be interpreted thusly. And I could easily see him going the other way, and then he could take somebody else with him. So I don't think it's
if there is in fact the ambiguity in that statute that you
I've read the statute referring I can find so it there. I can find a colorable case there. I'm not saying I agree with that side of the argument, but it's not nonsense. It's not you know.
So you think there's enough ambiguity in it to for the Supremes to uphold it?
It wouldn't surprise me either way. Let's just say that either way would not surprise me.
Fair enough.
You know, I think that, by the way, that Biden should have gone for the full Monty. I think he should have gone and said extinguished all the accounts. That would have actually created, I think, a lot more momentum to buy those votes, Tim, because I think those professionals you talked about that are you suggest would vote for him out of gratitude. I just don't think 10K is enough for them to do.
Well, I think he thinks that they will. Okay, I'm not saying that they will.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's going to cost him. Look, the whole thing about the boomerang is that I think it's going to boomerang on him, and he'll know it when Republicans start using it as a talking point during the fall campaign, just like, you know, they're going to use the IRS expansion as a talking point in the fall campaign. You know, they have to be careful about the things that you do in an election year. And I'd say this is pretty reckless, Scott, politically. It's quite reckless of Biden.
Well, he's got to do something, I guess, right? I mean, Jill wants another 4 years of being ridden around like she's the, you know, Queen of Sheba over there. So something's got to give. The other thing I just want to make sure that we talk about, I really think it's a tragedy that people aren't talking about this. And I think it's something that could really unite Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and progressives, and certainly libertarians, which is the reason why we've got this this crisis with the student loans is because of a exception in United States of bankruptcy law. The only class of debt that I'm aware of outside of taxes that may be non-discharged in a bankruptcy is educational debt. So
that's for
you. Want to go to the most expensive university in the country and study basket weaving and borrow a gazillion dollars to get your degree, even though the highest paid basket weaver in the world only makes, you know, I don't know, whatever, put a number on it, 20 grand a year, 50 grand a year, 100 grand a year, and you'll never be able to pay back. Well, they don't care because there are people now who are retired, 65 and older, who get their loan, their Social Security checks, some garnishment to take out for their college loans because they're still paying because those loans can never be extinguished. And so what that does, Tim, is it makes the loan issuer issue loans they never would under real market conditions, which includes a likelihood of being repaid and the credit worthiness and likelihood that the person, borrowing those loans will repay them. And they've removed the market from it. And those market controls, as you might imagine, function to actually produce loans in people who are likely to repay them. So they're selling loans. So the law is designed to actually laden debt on people who should never be able to get that debt in the first place. It's like encouraging home ownership to a degree where those people really aren't, they shouldn't have homes, not because it's a moral judgment, but they haven't done the necessary precursors, right? They don't know how to keep up a place. They don't understand what to do, like whatever.
Well, student loan debt is, it's a function of how ambitious you are. And if you're ambitious enough to take on all the debts that involved in going to college, then, part of the price you pay for that, there's no free lunch as much as, progressives want to make everything as free as possible at the expense of the population writ large. But it'll be very curious to see how this goes down with the American people. It's not going to be a principal area of interest. The economy is still going to be the number one issue. Abortion's going to be very high. But I think if it's used deftly by Republicans, it could result in some real problems for Democrats who have some splaining to do, because they'll be put in a position. Look, congressional candidates will be put in a position, Scott, of saying, well, do you support your president on this bailout to the tune of $300, $600, $900 billion, whatever it's going to be?
More.
They're going to put these Democratic candidates on the spot. Do you support this or not? And do you support the expansion of the IRS so that there's 87,000 more employees coming in the next 10 years who are interested in your taxes? I mean, see, these are things that I think the Republicans can use strongly to their advantage if they are effective campaigners, which to this moment, I will just drop in, Scott, I don't believe that they have been. They've been relying strictly on the weakness of Joe Biden and Democrats, and they're going to have to take some positions of their own, because the Democrats can rightly claim that whether you like it or not, they've passed legislation, the CHIPS Act, they have passed, of course, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really about, of course, IRS expansion and tax increases and climate change. It's not at all about inflation, but they can claim that they've done all of these things. Republicans are going to have some kind of an answer, because, of course, elite media cannot be counted on to.
Well, they can pick up that whole spectrum. Pick up that whole bankruptcy reform thing from me and have it free of charge, and get progressives to weigh in on it too, because there actually is change that can be made. Because this is just going to, we're just kicking the can down the road. It's going to just balloon and balloon and balloon.
What do you expect when the federal government, you had to know that something like this would happen when the federal government during the Obama administration took over the entirety of student loans in this country instead of private lenders. Now, I'm sure there's some good things about it.
I actually support that. And here's why. What happened in the private lender thing was, with a lot of it, it was just a subsidy for. So if the government is going to guarantee a loan that you service, but you get market rates for the loan, like you're incurring risk when you have none, it's just a giveaway to the bank. So in that instance, I mean, call me a socialist, but I guess I like that they actually just, started basically not pretending that banks were engaged in risk taking when they were just loan servicers, and they were being paid as if they were taking risk. But again, this is a second layer in the onion in terms of, let's just say this in terms of how to think about it. If you and I were on like a loan committee, And we were like, there was like a, you know, a whole bunch of people put in their money into a hedge fund. That's what we're talking about, a hedge fund. We were hedge fund managers, Tim, and we were part of that hedge fund had to be in college loans. Would we give the same loan to somebody who was like, yeah, I'm a A-plus student in organic chemistry, and I hope to work for a pharmaceutical company and nanobot, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then somebody else was like, I'm a genderqueer, non-binary person who hopes to really expand the drag show reading hour stuff. Like, you know, and, you know, we would just assess people's, like, what's the likelihood that this person is going to repay their, you know,
right.
And the loan would be evaluated based on that. That's what that kind of market conditions with respect to these loans needs to either be applied, or we need to go full socialism and just give away the college education and say, okay, you get community college free or whatever. But
well, of course, that's what the left wants to do. They want free community college.
At least then you wouldn't get what we have now. I think it's the worst of both worlds. And of course, tuition is just going to keep going up and up to meet the increased subsidy, because they know that they can soak people for what they can soak them for.
Well, you know, and they also know, this is a good point, Scott, they also know that when it comes down to it, the politicians have shown a willingness to bail out people. So what's to stop, you know, the rising generation to demand a bailout on something else? Because, well, you did it for student debt, and certainly we're out of college now. There's all kinds of other things that we need assistance on.
Right. Even from want coming to a coming to an election promise near you.
Yes, exactly.
All right. We'll punt on Dr. Fauci for we'll save him for next week. let you go here.
That one, yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Ciao.
Thank you, Scott. See ya.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, LN Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser, or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of libertynation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Contributor for LibertyNation.com.
I'm starting to make an impact. Liberty style. Fight for freedom.
Maybe tracking polls sponsored by Liberty Nation for Thursday.
Mentioned by Dan Bongino, Rasmussen, Jordan Peterson, and others.
I can do it again if you want me to.
Cited in Mark Levin's American Marxism.
I think we're starting to make a really big impact. Getting noticed. We're doing it. Rock on. I'm gone.